This is Greyhound Nation, Episode 8, recorded Sunday, November 8th, 2020. Charlie Blanning in his latest Greyhound book. Greyhound Nation is a podcast for Greyhound enthusiasts produced by Greyhound enthusiasts. To learn more about our show and its hosts, visit our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Greyhound Nation podcast. I'm Michael Burns, and now, here's your host, John Parker.
Welcome back, everybody. Glad to have today a guest we've had in the past. And if there's a more prolific or more scholarly writer on greyhounds and greyhound sport, I'm yet to read him or her. Charlie Blanning has written a number of greyhound books, greyhound articles, reports on coursing, and we're just very glad to have him back. Welcome, Charlie.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here again.
So you've written another book on greyhounds. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, this book is called Please, Mister, The Golden Age of Greyhound Racing. And I got the title from Timothy Sean O'Brien, who's the great-grandson of Owen Patrick Smith, the man who could easily be called the father of greyhound racing because he invented the artificial lure, which first could be used on an oval greyhound racing track. And Timothy told me a marvelous story about his great-grandfather, that when he was the secretary of the National Coursing Meeting at Hot Springs in South Dakota, way back in 1906, he was watching the coursing and he felt a little tug at his coat. And a little voice said, "Please, mister." And he tried to ignore it, of course. And then another tug. "Please, mister, do they really have to kill the rabbit?" And that set Owen Patrick Smith thinking, because he'd never been too sure about it himself. And he thought that if only he could invent a system by which it took the live lure out of coursing, then it would be a marvelous thing for greyhound sport and also for spectator entertainment. And that's what he set out to do.
That's a great story. And I seem to recall that there was a further story about the little girl that tugged at O.P. Smith's sleeve.
Yes, she really existed. And she turned out to be, when she grew up, a very famous dancer called Irene Castle, who used to dance with her husband before the First World War. And she was enormously famous at the time. They think that she invented the bobbed hairstyle, also, which was so popular at the beginning of the 1920s. I think she also invented the foxtrot as well. And there's a movie about them with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers playing Irene Castle and Vernon, her husband. So she really existed, and we hope she really said it.
And I guess it's lost to history as to whether she realized that she planted the seed for the invention of greyhound racing.
Well, no, I think because I turned her up again in a magazine article in 1922, when O.P. Smith had opened his first greyhound track in Florida. And there's a mention there of Irene Castle taking an English journalist to see the racing. So it was obvious that she was still involved, still interested at the time when O.P. Smith was first opening his greyhound tracks. So, yes, she knew what fruit had been borne by her original suggestion.
That's great. Well, before we get into what your inspiration for the book is and how you came to write it and so forth, let's talk a little bit about those that are interested in getting the book. What's the current status of it? When do you expect it to be available? And how do folks go about ordering it?
Well, it was last sighted somewhere in the Mediterranean, making its way in a ship towards England, and we hope it's going to arrive here towards the end of November, and therefore it will be available for sale at least from the 1st of December. And what we're going to do is that we're going to market it through our Facebook page, which is called The Greyhound and the Hare. And if people go to that page, they will find on it a Buy Now button. And when you click the Buy Now button, it will provide you with a form which you complete simply to tell us who you are and where you're from. And from that, we will raise it an invoice, and people will be then requested to pay by PayPal or by credit card. And when we receive your payment, then we'll be able to post you the book.
And what's the price of it going to be?
The price of the book is going to be £35 sterling. And if you buy it in the UK, that will include your postage. If you buy it from Ireland, there will be £5 postage in addition. And if you buy it from America, it will be, the postage will be £15. Anywhere else in the world, the postage will be £10. But all this will be shown on the Facebook page. And we hope it will be a nice, easy method for people to obtain a book.
And for our American listeners, I believe our currency converter and producer, Mr. Burns, did the quick conversion, and that's with postage is $65.
Right.
So what inspired you to write the book right here on the heels of your great book, The Greyhound and the Hare?
I think it was because I've always been interested in all forms of greyhound sport, and that includes greyhound racing, of course. And I wanted to write something about the golden age of greyhound racing, when it was in its infancy and before it became too much of a business, when the what you might call the pioneers of the sport were involved in greyhound racing, and in particular the story of Owen Patrick Smith, who battled all kinds of difficulties and disasters before he actually managed to set up the first successful greyhound racing track, which was in Emeryville, California in 1920.
And I'm always interested in how authors go about researching and writing their books. Tell us a little bit about what you did and how you compiled all this great treasure of photos and illustrations and so forth.
Well, I'm very lucky. I never find writing difficult. I've never been frightened by the blank page. So writing to me is a pleasure. And research is also a pleasure as well, because looking through old magazines and old newspapers, trying to test some of the old legends against reality, all this led to all sorts of what I hope will prove for everyone, you know, interesting discoveries about how the sport started, and also, of course, the great personalities of greyhound racing, which are the greyhounds themselves, finding out the true stories of all the old legends, like Mission Boy and Racing Ramp. And eventually, of course, how greyhound racing spread throughout the world. Because although it was born in the United States, it quickly traveled abroad to places like the United Kingdom, to Ireland, to Australia, and so on and so forth. I mean, now, as both you, John, and I realize, because of the network of contacts that we have, particularly through social media, interest in greyhounds and greyhound ownership is truly global.
Yeah, absolutely. I also want to talk a little bit about the self-publishing process. I admire greatly authors who have the chutzpah and the determination to publish their own works. We're going to have in a few weeks another author, Kieran O'Brien, who's written a fabulous fiction story about greyhound racing, and he self-published. And the conversation with him brought to me the fact that interest in greyhounds in terms of writing and books and so forth is kind of a niche market that a lot of publishers just don't feel that there's the numbers to justify their going to the investment of publishing a book. So I think really to get our the writing and the chronicling of the breed out there, it's going to come up down to people that are interested in self-publishing. There's another author that has been urged to publish a collection of his essays. I won't mention his name, but his initials are Dennis McKeon. And we're going to work on Dennis to do the same thing you've done. How did you go about getting, just the physical mechanics of getting the book published?
Well, I was very lucky in as far as that a couple of years ago, the National Coursing Club and Greyhound Stud Book, which I've worked for 20 years, wanted a legacy project which would be a comprehensive history of greyhound sport. And they very kindly asked me to write it and pull it together for them. And while doing that, I also worked with a very old friend called Jeff Hayes, who's a book designer. And so through that project, through The Greyhound and the Hare, as it came to be called, of course, this was valuable experience in just what you needed to do to provide copy and photographs suitable for a book. And with Jeff's marvelous creative powers and advice, we created The Greyhound and the Hare for the National Coursing Club. And then I was able to turn to Jeff again when we were going to publish Please Mister, The Golden Age of Greyhound Racing. And the book has been deliberately designed to be of the same dimensions exactly of The Greyhound and the Hare. And people who have a copy of The Greyhound and the Hare will see that it's in a way a companion piece to that book, that it adds to it in much more detail, although we touched on greyhound racing in The Greyhound and the Hare, more than touched on it. People will find that in Please Mister, this, I hope, tells a pretty comprehensive story of just how greyhound racing got started in its early days, and which I would see also as its glory days, its golden era.
That's wonderful. Now, and it's not... From the sound of it, it's not prohibitively expensive to self-publish these days.
Well, it's like a lot of things in greyhound sport. It's a gamble.
Yeah.
And I have a very tolerant and sympathetic family, particularly my wife, Sheila, who's always very supportive in these things. And she said, go for it. Come on, we'll do it. We'll do it. And so we did. And we're hoping that enough people out there will buy a copy and enjoy it so that, we get our costs back. But I have to admit here and now just how grateful I am for my wife Sheila's support, because apart from anything else, she's the most... marvelous editor and reader. And so if Please Mister proves to be a 100% mistake-free book, then it's all down to her. And she took hours and hours and hours of reading the proofs.
And is she still negotiating her fee for that?
I think she is, yes.
Well, great. Well, let's jump right into the history of greyhound racing. And I think it's a little known fact that actually the first greyhound race behind an artificial lure was not held in the U.S., but was held in England. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was, yes. It was in 1876, and it was at a place called the Welsh Harp in North London. And the Welsh Harp was what was known in those days as a pleasure ground. And I suppose a bit like an amusement park, or a theme park, as we would call them today. And they were always looking for new things to do at the Welsh Harp to attract the crowds. And they set up a course in which an artificial lure, a dummy hare, ran in a wooden rail. And the hare was drawn on what was known as a windlass, and i.e. was pulled up the wooden rail. And they ran the greyhounds after it as if it was a coursing meeting. So only two greyhounds ran at a time. And of course, the winner was the one which went across the winning line the first time. But the dogs were expected to run more than once a day, as if they were at a coursing meeting. And they ran two competitions, each had eight dogs. It was quite a success. A major problem that they always found with all greyhound racing meetings to begin with was if it rained. And most attempts to set up tracks always seem to start on the wettest day in weeks, and so that the equipment was always drowned, or the track was drowned, or whatever. Anyway, at the Welsh Harp, it rained as usual. But after a few false starts, they managed to run out the programme. But it never happened again. There was just that one meeting. There is no indication in the reports of the time or the press, which made quite a fuss about it at the first meeting. There's no indication they ever ran another meeting. And that was that.
So it just lay dormant for those many years until Owen Patrick Smith came along. And he was quite a unique individual. Tell us a little bit about his background.
Well, Owen Patrick Smith, he was born in Memphis, Tennessee, in 1867. And his father was an undertaker, which, as far as one could tell, in Memphis in those days was a pretty good occupation, because there were frequent outbreaks of yellow fever, which tended to carry off quite a large percentage of the population. So an undertaker was not a bad job to be in. Unfortunately, in the second major outbreak of yellow fever in Memphis, Tennessee, it carried off Owen Patrick Smith's father along with most of his family. So at that point, Owen Patrick and his younger brother fled to Chicago, and that's where he was brought up. And then he seems to have led almost a kind of sort of wandering life throughout the Midwest and the West, often acting as a sports promoter of some kind. He seems to have tried his hand at virtually everything, boxing, even tugs of war were very popular at the time. They drew a big crowd. And when he wasn't promoting sports, then he seemed to have worked as a bartender. He was, I understand, a well-known in Denver as being the best bartender in Denver. And it was for that he actually went, first of all, to Hot Springs in South Dakota at the turn of the 1900s, because he went there to be the barman at a place called the Ozark Club, which was a combination of a saloon, a betting room, a restaurant, and so on and so forth. But he was obviously a very talented promoter, because all the local businessmen, they got their heads together and they decided what Hot Springs, South Dakota needed to bring in the crowds, because that's all it existed for. It was a resort with Hot Springs, as the name of the town tells you. What they needed was a coursing meeting. So they sent off Owen Patrick to the coursing in 1905, I think it was taking place somewhere in Kansas, to try and get the National Coursing Association to stage their big meeting of the year at Hot Springs in 1906. And O.P. Smith, as we'll call him from now on, OP was appointed the secretary and general organizer of the meeting, and he was also responsible for publicizing it throughout the Midwest, so the crowds would come in. And he did a marvelous job. It was one of the most extraordinary course of meetings I think probably ever run in the United States. It went on for over a fortnight. Thousands of people came to watch it, and people were so impressed that the following year, when the meeting was going to take place at Salt Lake City in Utah, they actually invited OP to go to Salt Lake City to run it for them. So he was becoming the go-to man as far as promoting greyhound sport in the States at the time was concerned. But by this stage, our little girl, of course, has sown the seed in his mind that perhaps they could have a form of greyhound sport which didn't actually include live lures, which, apart from anything else, would silence the anti-lobby, which was already becoming quite vociferous in some places, particularly in Salt Lake City itself.
Now, in those early coursing events that he promoted and had success at, was wagering a significant element, or was it just the sport of it that attracted people?
I think it depended. The meeting which OP organized in South Dakota was on behalf of the National Coursing Association, and the two great events which were run was one called the Futurity, which was for puppies, and the other was the great event for all-age greyhounds, which was called the Waterloo Cup. They had borrowed the title of the Waterloo Cup from the celebrated event which took place in England every year. And I think most of the people who were concerned with the National Coursing Association were particularly from places like Kansas, Oklahoma, and Missouri. They were mainly concerned with the sport. That's what they liked best, was watching greyhounds run and breeding them and owning them. And there was a considerable amount of these meetings in the Midwest at the time. That wasn't always the case. If the coursing took place in cities like San Francisco and Los Angeles, where it was extremely popular, there was enormous betting on it. And that's what normally got the meetings into trouble with the local authorities. It wasn't the coursing which they objected to, it was the betting. And particularly as in San Francisco and Los Angeles, what you might call the traditional day for these coursing meetings was always on a Sunday, which went down very badly with, of course, the church lobby, as you can imagine.
Gambling's bad enough. Gambling on Sunday's an abomination, no doubt.
Yeah, that's what they felt about it. And at the particularly San Francisco was a great center for it. And at Union Park and Ingleside, where they used to course every Sunday, winter and summer, they didn't seem to be too worried what time of the year it was. You would literally have thousands of people there. And the pools, as they were known, pool betting, which we in England call tote betting, totalisated betting. I have, and there's a picture in the book showing the long queues at what were known as the pool booths for them to place their bets.
Now, obviously, the invention of greyhound racing was tied closely to the mechanics of developing the artificial lure. Did OP have a particularly mechanical talent, or did he bring in some folks with that kind of a background to help him develop the lure?
No, he was a natural born inventor himself. And what he managed to create was really a sort of miniature electric trolley, which ran on a railway. And that was to carry the artificial hare. Now, we think, his family think, that he'd had experience of electric railways and trolleys in Chicago because he'd worked on it, I think during the World Fair, because I'm not sure whether, I think that was in the 1890s, so about 10 years before he turned up in South Dakota. He'd worked at the World's Fair in Chicago, and it was noticed quite early on that the control mechanism and the lever which controlled the hare, the speed of the hare, bears an extraordinary resemblance to that of a trolley car in Chicago. That it looks as if OP borrowed the idea. And I think I remember someone telling me that there was a system in London still in the 1950s, which still used, it still looked like a Chicago trolley car from the 1890s.
Now, OP didn't immediately strike gold. Tell us about his failed attempts in various cities.
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, poor OP. He started off in Salt Lake City in 1908, and he by that stage he had invented his what he called his inanimate hare conveyor, and this was the railway idea. And he hired a baseball field called Walker's Field, and actually set the track up. And a photograph, I was absolutely thrilled to find this. A photograph survives showing the dogs leaving the traps, as they're known, in pursuit of the hare. And you can see just in the background of this very grainy photograph, the control tower from which the hare was controlled. And for all life, I mean, it is the same system which he eventually perfected. But sadly, we come back to the wet as usual. It rained and it rained and it rained. The track would become choked with mud and silt, and the hare would fail. And eventually he ran out of money, and he failed to run a meeting at Salt Lake City. But he then turns up a year later. He was a man of considerable determination in Tucson, Arizona. Now, I sometimes think that probably OP hoped it was going to be drier in Tucson than it actually had been in Salt Lake City. And there he set up a track which actually did run a meeting. People blithely say that the first Greyhound race meeting ran an oval track was at Emeryville in California. But in fact, as early as 1910, he managed to run a meeting at an amusement park called the Elysian Grove. It didn't go very well, but at least, I think the first meeting was on the 6th of March. By the 3rd of April, he had managed to actually have a program where they managed to run all the races without the hare system failing. But then all of a sudden, the meeting stops. And basically it's because OP has run out of money and he's run out of backers. And then from Tucson, he went to Houston. That got washed away by the rain. He then went to New Orleans in 1913. There it was floods, and I understand a boll weevil plague seemed to have prevented him from successfully staging his meeting. And he then went a bit quiet, but by 1918, he pops up again in Chicago, which is, of course, is where he grew up, trying to run a meeting at the Palatine Amusement Park. But there the problem was, because, of course, it was the latter stage of the First World War, he couldn't get the necessary building materials to build his track. But at last, in 1920, he teams up with a man whom he had met back, certainly he knew him in Salt Lake City, if not in South Dakota, a man called George Sawyer, who was a boxing promoter. And he meets up with George again in California in 1920, and together they managed to construct the first track at Emeryville, which is part of Oakland near San Francisco.
And I believe you've discovered in your research that the original designated date for the first race meet in Emeryville was incorrect, didn't you?
I'm afraid so, yes. that everyone always said that the first, you know, they said, when was the first Greyhound racing meeting? And everyone says, 1919. Well, I'm sorry, it wasn't. The first meeting at Emeryville was on the 29th of May, 1920. And that's certain. That's in print. So how it happened was that George Sawyer was at that time a boxing promoter. And he had a boxing auditorium in Emeryville. And the crowds were becoming so large that it had to move to another auditorium in Oakland itself, because George Sawyer had on his books an extremely promising young heavyweight called Jack Dempsey. And this was very early in Jack's career, but people were already flocking to see him, you know, not one person after another over. So suddenly the auditorium in Emeryville became redundant. So what George did, George Sawyer did, was that he took the old auditorium down, and the timber was carried off to a piece of land which he owned just down the street. And that was used to build the grandstands for the Greyhound track at Emeryville. And Sawyer and OP were partners until OP's death in 1927.
You know, that's another question that I think of. In addition to the development of the lure, how did they find the venues back then? And what was the nature of the tracks? Were they plowed up in, you know, sand or dirt surfaces, or did they just go out and find a field and run on the grass?
Certainly, I think at Emeryville it was dirt. And, of course, the tradition in American thoroughbred racing, of course, is to run on dirt. So that was nothing new. And expecting greyhounds to run on dirt was no different from expecting thoroughbreds to run on the dirt. And Emeryville was a dirt track. And it was set up, of course. This is the other important thing is, of course, that it had to be accessible. And the site in Emeryville was had a notorious reputation. One of its the local law enforcers used to call it the most rotten town in California. And I expect there was some stiff competition at the time too. So Emeryville had its saloons, its gambling joints, its whorehouses, and now it had a dog track as well. People went to Emeryville for fun.
What do you think, why did it take off there, having failed at these other cities? What was it that, got Greyhound racing off to a successful start in Emeryville, where it had failed other places?
Well, it failed in other places mainly because OP ran out of money. Some of his critics used to think that OP stood not for Owen Patrick Smith, but other people's Smith, because he was always borrowing money to try and, you know, float his tracks. George Sawyer also, of course, provided financial backing. That was another important function for George. But so I think the tracks up until the establishment of the track at Emeryville, it wasn't that the people didn't go. They couldn't go because, unfortunately, the track would fail because of lack of funds before they could really get it racing. And what happened at Emeryville was that they managed to get the lure going. They had a stadium. They had grandstands. And they had a clientele, of course, who were willing to gamble, because San Francisco at the time, you know, the old gold rush city, had a gambling fever. And that had been shown in the early 1900s when they had the enclosed coursing at Union Park in Ingleside. At one time, San Francisco, I think, had seven different coursing parks were competing, and thousands of San Franciscans would go. So Emeryville was a pretty good place to start.
That's amazing. So, and then where did he go from Emeryville? What was his next venture?
Well, after that, they went to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And the reason they went there was because there was a local promoter who had come to Emeryville, and he'd seen the racing at Emeryville, and he thought it would be a very good idea to have it at Tulsa as well. And it was a pretty good idea, because Tulsa at the time was the oil city of the United States of America. It was awash with money, and there were plenty of gamblers in Tulsa who were more than willing to spend night after night at the dogs. So before Emeryville even Emeryville closed eventually, but that's another story. Before Emeryville closed, George Sawyer and Opie Smith went to Tulsa to set up the track there, and it was an enormous success. Let no one tell you that these early Greyhound tracks were failures because people didn't go or people weren't interesting. The track at Tulsa, I think, paid for itself on the first night, because there were so many punters willing to wager. And they ran day after day after day, because as with American thoroughbred tracks, they didn't race, say, two nights a week or something like that. They raced every day that they could, day after day.
How did they find enough greyhounds to fill the programs?
Well, that was another good reason for starting in California. There was a strong, and always had been, a strong coursing element in San Francisco, in California. Open coursing, as we called it in England, was extremely popular in California from the 1860s. So if you were going to find enough greyhounds, California was an extremely good place to start. And, of course, then on top of that, out in Oklahoma and Kansas and Missouri were all the people who used to go to the national coursing meetings all over the Midwest, and they had plenty of dogs. And if farming wasn't going to go too well, well, then there were always greyhounds. So there was no shortage of dogs. It's been often claimed, that one of the problems of the early tracks was that there weren't enough dogs to go around, and that therefore, and they would point to the fact that dogs were expected to run more than once, say, in an afternoon meeting. That's not true. The cards which I've seen are consistently, they're always about six races, they're all for six dogs each. And when dogs ran more than once in an afternoon, it was because it was a special competition in which they ran heats at the beginning of the afternoon, and then they'd run a trophy final at the end. So there were plenty of dogs in California, and there were plenty of dogs waiting out in the Midwest to run as well.
Does history record whether OP was a particularly lover of the breed itself? Did he own greyhounds, breed greyhounds?
Well, it's difficult to tell. Some sources will tell you that he was the best known greyhound man in the States. Others will tell you that his first experience of greyhounds was actually when he got the meeting together in South Dakota. One thing that appears in the book, I've got a newspaper cutting picture from the meeting in Salt Lake City, where we have OP actually holding a couple of greyhounds, ready to take them to slips. So, was he a great greyhound man? I don't know. But if he wasn't, there are plenty of others who were. George Sawyer knew plenty about greyhounds. He'd been brought up in Nebraska. And what they don't know about greyhounds in Nebraska isn't worth knowing. And also, of course, he had the assistance of a man called George Heintz. And George Heintz ran the Oakland kennels. And his dogs were always called Oakland this and Oakland that. And he was very well known in Californian coursing circles. And it's thought that he was given shares in the Emeryville track in exchange for acting as the agent to recruit all the dogs. Because apart from anything else, a lot of the old-time coursing boys wouldn't believe that a greyhound would chase an artificial lure. And the story is that there were some of them hanging about in Emeryville one day, saying, the dogs ain't going to check, you know, hey, they ain't going to chase that old P. So OP took the dummy hare off the hare rail, attached his handkerchief to the hare rail, and ran the hanky round the track, slipped the dog on it, and of course the dog chased it chased it as hard as he could go. Because what you and I know is, of course, with a good greyhound, will chase anything.
Yeah, chase absolutely.
Your finger.
Yeah. So OP makes his way to Florida. And yep. That finally seems to be where it really became a phenomenon. Tell us about that.
Well, between Tulsa and Florida, he'd been to St. Louis and had an enormous success with track there. And what happened in Florida was that he was invited by a big landowner who had a lot of land on the north side of Miami. And they were looking for attractions to, you know, attract tourists and so on and so forth. And they invited OP to go to Florida and set up a track at a place called Hialeah. And that he did, and it proved an enormous success. In Florida, in the early 1920s, was an enormous land boom there, biggest land boom for decades. And people were flooding into Florida. And Miami was spreading, and the track was where people wanted to go. The photographs of the crowds at Hialeah for the big events like the Derby, the place is absolutely rammed with people.
Where else did he set up tracks in Florida?
Hialeah was the big track as far as OP was concerned, and that was his original track. And then, of course, you know, when people see a good idea, they can't wait to copy it. And so the next, I think the second track to be set up in Florida was St. Petersburg, which eventually became known as Derby Lane.
Yeah. Now, did OP license his artificial lure to these other tracks that were owned by other individuals? How did that work?
Well, that's what he hoped to do. He hoped, in fact, to be more interested in hiring out the patent of his electric hare to these various tracks and making, you know, a good business out of that. But of course, unfortunately, once you've had a very good idea, people come up and copy it. And the major character, who was only too keen to copy O.P. Smith's original idea, was his old friend George Heinz from California. And George started to set up his own tracks, to which O.P. and his associates referred to as outlaw tracks. And that led to litigation. And it was litigation which went on for numbers and numbers of years, even after O.P. Smith himself had died suddenly in 1927.
And it was from the greyhound racing coming to Florida that it eventually got taken over to England, wasn't it?
That's right. What happened was that there was an American socialite called Charles Alexander Munn II. And Charlie Munn was an exceedingly smooth operator. His family were ridiculously wealthy, and he spent most of his time in Europe. And on a trip back to the States in 1925, it was, I think, to a society wedding in Philadelphia, he owned a house on the beach at Palm Beach in Florida, flew down to his house at Palm Beach. And while he was there, he saw greyhound racing for the first time. Now, Charlie may have been very wealthy, but he was also very bright. And he was a very, very, very talented entrepreneur. So before he left the States, left Florida in 1925, he had come to a deal with O.P. Smith. I have a picture of them together, to take the mechanism over to England and to start greyhound racing in Europe.
How did he go about it? Who did he meet with first in England to make that happen?
Well, famously, he met a man called Major Lyon Dixon in a club called Bucks Club in London, you know, one of those smart London clubs. And Major Lyon Dixon was a great coursing man, and he used to judge a lot of the smartest coursing meetings in England. And he and Charles Munn got together, and Charlie Munn said, look, I'll go out and get the bobs, in other words, the money. You go out and get the dogs. So that was the deal. Munn would find the money if Lyon Dixon could find the dogs. And famously, they met again a month or so later, and they said, one said to the other, right, what did you get? He said, not a bob, not a dog. No one would pay, you know, pay any attention to them. And they were simply laughed at. But eventually, they got a man called General Critchley, who, despite his military rank, was a great cement entrepreneur, would you believe? And he backed them, and by getting the money together, Munn's money and Critchley's money and Lyon Dixon's dogs, they started a track in Manchester in 1926, and it just mushroomed from there. Because what had been quite a sensation in America was an enormous success in the United Kingdom. It was huge. Absolutely beyond belief. Greyhound racing in England in the late 1920s was a license to print money.
And one of the things the British didn't have to contend with was the worries with law enforcement over gambling, because sports betting was much more accepted in England, right?
That's right. I mean, the early Greyhound tracks in the United States fought an endless guerrilla war against the authorities in attempting to, you know, to manage to have betting on their tracks. Whereas in England, you could bet on anything you liked. So the problem didn't exist. We were much more liberal.
I've always enjoyed your writing and stories about how the coursing organization, National Coursing Club and so forth in England, made a bit of a historical blunder in passing on being involved in greyhound racing. Tell us about that.
Yes, they were marvelously snobbish about it, because of course in England, particularly at that time, everything is ruled by class, and the National Coursing Club was invited by Major Lyon Dixon to become the controlling authority of the new sport, which, of course, would have enriched the National Coursing Club beyond belief. But no, they wouldn't have anything to do with that. Dear. Greyhound racing, nothing to do with coursing. Oh, my goodness, no. So that was the end of that. I have to say that in Ireland, the man who was the major mover and shaker in the Irish Coursing Club was called Tom Morris. And he was a solicitor in Clonmel, and he didn't have any doubts about it at all. As soon as he saw greyhound racing, he said, right, we're going to have that, and we, the Irish Coursing Club, are going to run it. And run it they did.
That's they had more foresight than the Brits and weren't quite the snobs.
They weren't so stuck up. Oh, dear. The worst, of course, the National Coursing Club was ruled and had been ruled for what seemed like centuries by the Earls of Sefton. And the Earls of Sefton, they weren't exactly the brightest sandwiches in the lunchbox. So they just couldn't see the fortune that was going to be made.
Well, let's turn to the great greyhounds of the early days of racing. Who was the first great American greyhound that really made a name for itself?
Well, the great dog of the early days was called Mission Boy, and he raced, it seemed, everywhere. He started at Emeryville, and he was still racing what seemed to be years later in Florida. He ran Florida, St. Louis, Chicago, California, Tulsa. Mission Boy ran in all of them. And Jack Fisher, who was a great track official and was a track official for many, many years, right from the 1920s, I think, up into the 1940s or even 1950s, he swore that Mission Boy won 47 races in a row.
That's amazing. How did he get around the? How did they get him around the country in those days so quickly? Rail or?
He was bought and sold a couple of times, but quite quickly he was he came into the kennel of a man from Tulsa called Lawrence Freeman. And of course, when one track would sometimes, they would run a season and then they would close, and then everyone would get on the train and go to another track and start all over again. And people like Lawrence Freeman, I mean, they made their living out of greyhound racing, after all. And so Mission Boy and Lawrence Freeman and all his other dogs, when the season finished at St. Louis, then they would go to Florida. And when that finished, they'd go to New Orleans, and then they would go to Chicago, and so on and so forth. And Mission Boy ran everywhere. But even he eventually retired. He was known as Old Jerry.
And eventually, how did he perform at stud, or was he put to stud?
I think he covered a few bitches. I think there are indications that he had some litters. I don't think he was a runaway success by any manner of means. He was a Californian coursing bred dog, of course, himself. He was by two well-known Californian courses. And when he retired, Jack Dempsey had him as a pet.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So across the pond, then, who was the first great English course racing greyhound?
Well, the first winner of the English Greyhound Derby, that was in 1927, was a dog called Entry Badge. And he was owned and bred by a man called Edwin Baxter, who was a big coursing owner, naturally enough. And Entry Badge, I think he was beaten in his first race at the White City because he wasn't quite sure what he was supposed to be doing. And after that, he was never beaten.
Amazing. And then we come to Mick the Miller.
Ah, yes, Mick the Miller. Of course, a marvelous dog. The great thing about Mick the Miller was not only was he a great greyhound, and he won any number of greyhound classics. He won the English Greyhound Derby twice, but he was a great personality. He was well known for that. He had a great waggy tail. His tail was, one has to say, Mick himself, he was not the best looking greyhound in the world. He looked just a little bit sort of coarse, and he had a bit of a sort of hairy tail. But he used to flap it backwards and forwards at the crowd. And the crowd loved him for it because he always looked, always wanted to race. When he was retired, they once paraded him on the night of the Greyhound Derby final, and they paraded him past the tracks, and he lunged to try and get into them. although he was retired and he wasn't meant to race, as soon as they led him past the tracks, he tried to get in through the back door.
That's amazing. And what did he do at stud?
He was quite successful, but not as successful, I suppose, as people might have hoped. But he got a classic winner himself. At one time, one of his sons was held the world record for 500 yards. He was quite successful, but not what you would have hoped for from a dog who has such a great racing record. But what a personality.
Yeah, and he went on to make a movie.
And then, and he starred in his own movie as well, which is marvelous. It's a lovely movie. Lovely.
Wild Boy.
Yeah, Wild Boy.
still seen occasionally on YouTube if you're lucky.
Oh, don't miss it. Don't miss it.
Where did Mick live out his life?
He went to start in England, in Norfolk. His trainer was called Sidney Orton. Sidney Orton had been a Norfolk farmer, and he'd used to slip coursing meetings, and farming wasn't doing terribly well in the mid-1920s. And so when the track at Wimbledon opened, Sidney Orton went there and became a trainer, and he had Mick the Miller train. And when he was retired, he went up to Norfolk to stand at stud. He finished his days, though, back at Wimbledon with Sidney Orton. He died just before the beginning of the Second World War, 1939.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's your most memorable, other than OP, of course, who would be your most memorable greyhound racing character on the human side of things, Charlie?
Well, I think as far as the book is concerned, I was fascinated by Charlie Munn, the American who took greyhound racing to England. He lived into his 90s. He was still the star of the Palm Beach social scene, even in his 90s. And he was a quite amazingly clever and successful businessman. Apart from introducing greyhound racing to England, to Europe, he also managed to corner the market in automatic totalizator machines, both in Europe and in the United States of America. In the 1930s and 1940s, every automatic totalizator which was used on an American horse track had somehow passed through Charlie Munn's hands. He was a very, very clever guy.
So he stayed active and involved in greyhound racing throughout his life.
Well, certainly through the 30s, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot here. In your estimation, who's the greatest, which is the greatest greyhound that ever raced on either side of the pond?
Oh, that ever raced? I'm going to go for a dog which I actually saw race myself, and that's a dog called Westmead Hawk.
He won the
English Greyhound Derby twice. I was lucky enough to see him do it. And the great thing about Westmead Hawk was that he didn't win his races from the start. He could come through the field. And, of course, the crowds loved him for it because there he would be. In one of his Derby finals, he came out of the second bend last and still managed to get up to win. Now, that's a thrill beyond conception. Absolutely marvelous. He was a wonderful dog. And he was very successful at stud as well. He was bred and trained by a man called Nick Saber. I'm glad to say, is still with us. And Nick bred some of the best greyhounds that ran in England for the last 40 or 50 years.
Yeah. Well, you've covered the golden age of greyhound racing. Look into your crystal ball and tell us if there will be another golden age of greyhound racing, at least in England and Ireland.
I don't think so. I'm afraid. I'm afraid those days are gone. It's all a long story, but it's not that the English have stopped betting, but they now bet on other things. And they have other ways to bet. So I think the excitement, the adventure, and at one time, even as I show in my book, the glamour of greyhound racing, I'm afraid that's a thing of the past.
Yeah, it's rather sad as we watch the demise of racing where it started here in the U.S. and hopefully, Charlie Munn's act of taking it over to England will help it survive, into the future, even though it may not return to the glory days that it once enjoyed.
What I fear most for, as I know you do as well, is for the greyhound breed itself.
Yeah.
That when greyhound sport has gone, whither then the greyhound? Such a rotten shame.
Yeah, it really is. Well, on a brighter note, you have a, I think you've got another book in your head. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I try to claim it's not my fault, because an Irish friend of mine, when he heard that Please Mister was finished, he said, well, what are you going to do next? He said, why don't you write up the last years of the Waterloo Cup? Because there are two great books about the Waterloo Cup. One's called 56 Waterloo Cups by Loie Hall. The other one was then by an old mentor of mine, Edwards Clark, who took the story of the Waterloo Cup, every year of it, up until 1977. And this chap said, well, why don't you finish it? So that's what I'm going to have to do. I'm going to have to sit down and write what will turn out to be 22 Waterloo Cups.
Is that the working title?
Yep.
Excellent. that'll be a particular interest to me, because I was at the last seven Waterloo Cups.
Yes, yes.
Well, Charlie, it's been a great hour. Let's talk one more time about acquiring the book as it makes its way on the ship. You've been tracking, you and Sheila have been tracking the progress of the ship that the copies of the book are on, and tell us a little bit about when you expect it to arrive in England.
Well, now it's escaped Somalian pirates and other hazards like that. We're hoping that it's going to reach England in the last week of November. So being practical about it, we hope to be able to send copies out from the 1st of December.
And tell us again how to order.
And to do that, we hope that you'll go to our Facebook page, which is The Greyhound and the Hare, and that on The Greyhound and the Hare, you will find a Shop Now button. Click that, and it will give you a simple form to fill up in which you put your name and your email address, and we will then send you an invoice for the amount of money that you need to pay either by PayPal or by credit card. And when that payment has come to us, then we will post you the book.
Excellent. Well, we'll all look forward to that. It's a great, it'll make a great Christmas present for folks. If you've got a greyhound lover in your family, and unlike the greyhound and the hare, it weighs a little bit less than 8 pounds, and you may even could read it in the bath, right, Charlie?
Yeah, but only just. Only just. I have to say that it's as I said, it's the same dimensions, the greyhound and the hare, but it's a bit thinner. But you won't have to put it on a table to read it. This one you will be able to read in the conventional way. But don't drop it in the bath.
Well, Charlie, it's been a most enjoyable hour with you. We will definitely, there's many more Greyhound topics to cover in the future episodes, so you'll be back as a frequent guest. Thanks for spending this hour with us, and everybody go out and buy Please Mister.
That's very kind, John. I'm most grateful.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. You can subscribe to Greyhound Nation wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the show, be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. You can also write to us via the contact form on our website, greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. We're also on Facebook. Search for our Grey Nation Show page. You can also tweet at us. It's at Grey Nation Show on Twitter. If you're an Instagram user, we're there too. Just follow us at Grey Nation Show. This episode was produced in collaboration with host John Parker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dimitri Taurus. Thanks also to Charlie Blanning for joining us for a second time on the podcast. Charlie's new book, Please Mister, The Golden Age of Greyhound Racing, will be available in early December. Search for his Facebook page, Greyhound and Hare, to learn how to order. I'm Michael Burns, and you've been listening to Greyhound Nation.